This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
I'm Wong Xiaoning and this is The Breakfast Grill. 136 billion ringgit, that's the last official realizable asset value of Khazanah revealed in 2018. But with a new mandate put in place since then, is Malaysia's sovereign wealth fund on track to achieve its twin goals of creating sustainable value while generating financial returns? But as COVID-19 and volatile markets made this even more challenging. To answer this question and more, we speak to Datuk Shahrul Rizwan, Managing Director of Khazanah National. Now, thank you for joining us on The Breakfast Grill. I think first off, we have to address the annual review, which was revealed last week, delivering a return of 2.69 billion ringgit for 2020, but a significant decline from 7.4 billion in 2019. Now, you've built that performance as steady in volatile markets. My big question is, would it have been worse if the investment mandate had not been revamped in 2018 to divide the portfolio into commercial and strategic funds?
Well, good morning, and thanks so much for having me here. I think the answer to that is a bit nuanced because, you know, what we tried to do with the reset of the strategy is actually a few things. Firstly, in 2018, it was quite clear, basically, that I think we needed to be very clear about what Khazanah National is for the people of Malaysia. And the decision was basically taken that we would have twin mandates, a commercial mandate and hence a commercial fund, which focuses really on delivering long-term sustainable value on a risk-adjusted basis for Malaysia. And a strategic fund, which is really more focused on holding and investing in strategic assets. And by this, we mean assets which not only provide a commercial return, but also essentially deliver other long-term economic benefits in terms of either opportunities or job creation for Malaysia. So when you look at what we delivered in 2020, yes, obviously there's a decline in terms of the profit numbers vis-a-vis 2019. And that it really, when you look at the details of what we announced last week, is really attributable to the impact of COVID and what it's had in relation to basically the performance of local markets. We had an impact on valuations and also, of course, a direct impact to some of the strategic holdings that we do have, primarily in aviation and tourism. And therefore, we took a decision in 2020 to essentially do an impairment of about 5 billion ringgit on those assets to reflect basically the carrying value in line with good practices.
So another interesting observation I made is that strategic decision taken in 2018 to invest more domestically. Now, I want to understand the rationale for it, because if really Khazanah's main objective or one of the objectives is to be catalytic for Malaysia's economic growth, are we then limiting it by only looking at Malaysia?
So we actually do two things, right? So in our commercial fund, we've actually taken a different stance, which is basically that we actually are investing more globally in our commercial fund. And that's necessary because one of the key and very apparent things when I came into Khazanah, when I looked at the portfolio, was the fact that we were overly concentrated in Malaysia, even within Malaysia, overly concentrated in just a few companies. And that's, I think, a fact of history, really, about where Khazanah came from, how it came about, and how its assets were created. But obviously, I think from a risk management point of view and from a diversification of income point of view, that portfolio construction carried a lot of risks. So we took the decision in 2018 to start to do that reshifting of assets and very successfully done, and that process continues to this day. So if you look at our holdings of global assets, that's actually gone up by 5 percentage points of our total AUM over the last 2 years, and that's really helped us a lot. And if you look at the details, right, our holdings in global public markets especially returned more than 20% to us in both 2019 and 2020, reflecting, I think, the right decision to diversify away from over-concentrated risk. Not that Malaysia is bad, but basically just from a portfolio construct point of view, you do want to essentially manage some of these risks.
But for the strategic fund, the focus is still very much Malaysia, right?
So for the strategic fund, it's a bit different, right? Like I mentioned, the idea of the strategic fund has always been a developmental fund that's focused on Malaysia and essentially investing in Malaysia to create other opportunities for the economy. I think the big question for the strategic fund, and it's the one that, you know, we are discussing with the government today, really is where do we go from here? Because it's quite obvious to me, essentially, that what was strategic in the past may not be strategic for the long term and for the future. And you also have to remember as well that essentially if you want to create economic opportunities and growth, you do need to invest. You can't just continue to hold existing assets. So holding existing assets, it's maybe looks good for your portfolio. It looks good basically from a perception point of view, but actually does nothing in terms of spurring new economic development or new job opportunities. So there's a big question that needs to be asked and which we are debating with the government today about, are we holding the right strategic assets today? Or does it make sense to maybe recycle some capital from existing strategic assets into new strategic assets and making investments in technologies or economic sectors of the future?
So how are those discussions with the government? Because, you know, concurrently, we see so many plans to spur Malaysia's growth in this post-COVID-19 era, one of which is going to come up is the 12 Malaysia plan. But since then, we've had MyDigital, Jendela. So how does Khazanah fit into the overall government strategy?
So we are essentially the catalytic investor, right, which has a slightly different role. So government, if you think about the role of government in an economy, they have to focus on long-term strategic planning. They have to identify really where they want the economy to go to. You have to create policies and incentives and everything else that goes with it in order to encourage the right investments to go in. We perform the role really of having worked out with the government what sectors they'd like to focus on. How do we then play a role in terms of catalyzing investments? Whether we take on some of the longer-term investments, which private sector may be reluctant to do so, but with the view that by doing so, we create opportunities for the private sector to come in and fill in the gaps in other places. As an example, and it's not that we are going to do this, right? If you were to think of, for instance, electric vehicles, right, as a classic case of a long-term strategic plan that a country should be looking at, then you have to think about all the value chain, right, and all the sectors in it, right? Who will take on, for instance, the long-term infrastructure you need for charging networks? And maybe that's something that a catalytic investor should do versus basically a private sector investor who may be more focused on the automobile side or on the software side. So I think, you know, when you think about these things, you do have to think about stuff which is suitable for a strategic investor to play its role, to spur more investment to come in. And, you know, you also want to be careful to make sure that the catalytic investor is not overly crowding out areas where a private sector investor can come in and do their part. And I think that's important.
Yeah, because we are not always known to be innovative or, you know, forward-looking in terms of the industries that we are good in. Because we are still very much old economy, manufacturing, or even commodities like palm oil. In fact, known to start projects which tremendously fail in the past and have cost us a lot of money. For, let's say, steel, that was a big thing in the 1980s and 1990s. Didn't work out for Malaysia either. So, you know, considering the fiscal pains that we're going through, it's about spending that dollar and extracting the best value for it, right? So how careful is Khazanah in deciding, okay, this is the right investment. It will have the maximum multiplier effect, and this would lead to, you know, the one thing that all Malaysians want: better paying productive jobs, moving up the value chain.
So to me, I think it's very clear that governments are good at certain things, right? But they are probably not well equipped on other things. And a classic case in point basically is that, you know, historically, governments, not just the government of Malaysia, but governments all over the world, tend to be very poor in terms of being business builders. Right, identifying, starting a business, running it, mostly because the entrepreneurial streak that's required to make it a success doesn't exist. And even within Khazanah, I think we recognize that as well. Right?
So Khazanah is partnerships the better model then?
Partnership is a much better model. So, you know, Khazanah has had history in this as well. You know, we had in the past an agricultural portfolio where we tried to sometimes start an agricultural business, and those failed miserably because it's very, very difficult to have the same kind of entrepreneurial streak as somebody who's down on the ground and doing it.
And using his own money.
And using their own money. But we've had a lot of success where we've partnered with the right entrepreneurs. So in the agricultural space, for instance, Holstein's a great example, right? We partnered with the entrepreneur who started Holstein, and we provided capital and governance to help him to grow the business further. And Holstein today basically is the largest producer of fresh milk in Malaysia. And, you know, great story in terms of import substitution and providing healthy food for Malaysians, right? To the point whereby we're now thinking about whether we can take it to the next stage, which is potentially either an IPO or bring it to the market. And that, I think, demonstrates the model that we should be pursuing, which is to find the right entrepreneurs, back them, and allow them to run the business.
So you're not going to crowd out the local market, in fact?
We shouldn't. And we should also accept the fact that maybe sometimes we start a business or we get involved at the start of a business, but we should then hand over to the right entrepreneurs, right, to take over once, essentially, our role is done with these things.
Now, another thing you keep bringing up is the word long-term. I hear that many times. I also heard that during your press conference during the annual review. Now, the issue about this is that now you're having a discussion with the government about the new phase. But in Malaysia, we've had like a sudden change of government. So do change in governments change that whole conversation? And you've been here for two governments.
Yeah. So to me, basically, I think it's really all about whether you have the right strategies in place. So when I came in 2018, obviously it was under a different government, and that government approved the strategies that we have put into place today. When the government changed last year, we did sit down with the government again. And I think what was quite good was the fact, basically, I think there was an affirmation that the strategy that the customer management had put into place basically was the right strategy. And that's what we've carried on. Right. So I think what's important basically for any institution basically is that it needs to have longevity. You know, it needs to have basically a structure, processes and governance that outlive essentially governments and outlive basically the people who are running these organizations, right?
So just to be clear, has there really been a change in any strategic investment direction since the Perikatan National Government came to power and Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin actually became chairman of Khazanah?
So what's actually happened is that acceleration of that discussion, which I mentioned, which is really to talk about what's important for the future. I think what's been really good about Tan Sri and since taking over as chairman, basically, is that he's been very commercial-minded in terms of understanding that Khazanah does need to deliver on a commercial mandate as well, because without a strong commercial portfolio and commercial mandate, we won't have the resources to both support the government in terms of dividends and to also reinvest money.
Related to the government is this payment of 2 billion ringgit in dividends. It's 100% increase from last year. Now, has this been a challenge to Khazanah? Because when you look at it, it's despite an environment of a decline in profit to 2.9 billion, like I said earlier, versus 7.4 billion in 2019. So does this have an impact in your portfolio because maybe there was an urgency to make divestments before their time?
So if you look at what are the tensions in play, right? So you obviously have a short-term tension whereby your shareholder maybe requires more money. And you have to remember we are a 100% owned entity of the government versus the long-term requirement to reinvest. So in 2020, given the pressure that the government is going through with respect to supporting the economy, with a bigger budget, with all the COVID relief and everything else, I don't see any real problem with the fact that they do need more money and they're requiring us to extend more dividend into support them.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning, we're speaking to Datuk Shahrul Rizwan, Managing Director of Khazanah National. When we come back, is Malaysia Airlines Khazanah's biggest headache? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. In the hot seat this morning is Datuk Shahrul Rizwan, Managing Director of Khazanah National. Just before the break, we were asking if staying local is the best way forward for the National Sovereign Fund. Now, I want to get back to this conversation about, you know, what are the right sectors that Malaysia should position itself in for the future growth? Because I see, like in other sovereign funds, and let's compare ourselves with Singapore, Temasek. If I look at their website, they particularly focus on what they see as sustainable, forward-looking industries. And I think this year, it's really much on green energy. Is this something Khazanah is looking at? And, you know, can we get some specifics and colour on this?
Yes, we are looking actually at a lot of new things that potentially the country could do, particularly around sustainability and around responsible investing. It's become actually a big pillar for us starting this year. And that's really in line with, I think, the country's own commitments and, you know, our own commitment as a people towards helping to save the earth, right? So we are looking at that. We are trying to work with the government to think about, can we do more, for instance, in renewable energies? Can we do more in terms of sustainability around energy consumption and efficiency? Can we start to think about what's actually required for the Malaysian population as an aging country, right? And what is going to be the right investments to do today, which are going to be relevant to Malaysians in 20 years' time when we are an aging country, right? So there are all these questions, right? And it really ties back to what I said earlier about what is strategic for the future, right? And are we holding the right assets and are we investing in the right sectors today to educate for that?
So does this then mean you'll be re-looking at the existing significant investments of Khazanah, which are and currently still impacted by COVID-19? So I'm talking about things like team attraction and resorts, which comprises of Desaru, Legoland, and of course, Malaysian Airlines, all, you know, related to the fact that our country's borders are still shut and, of course, greatly impacted. And even Plus Highways, with no interstate travel allowed or very limited interstate travel allowed at the moment. If we look at your portfolio, do you think there was insufficient sectoral diversification?
Yeah, again, like I said, I think, you know, that's part of the history of how the assets came about in Khazanah, right? So think Malaysia Airlines, for instance, right? Malaysia Airlines basically was an asset which ultimately the government took back many years ago from private sector hands. And I guess you could question whether that was ever the right decision at the point in time. But setting history to one side, we are now the custodians of Malaysia Airlines. Right. So in 2018, when I came in, I did table to the board at the point in time a number of options that we could take with Malaysia Airlines. And I think it's an open secret that we were looking at trying to bring in a strategic investor to come in and essentially start to take it off our hands, which is the right thing to do. I don't think really that going forward for the long term, we should be averse to the idea that other shareholders can perhaps add more value. It's the same argument about why we're doing Siltara, for instance, and we're disposing of Siltara, right? The argument being basically that it actually might do much better in the hands of private sector investors.
After $8 billion of losses since 1995.
Precisely, right? And it comes back to my earlier point that sometimes governments are not the best entities to actually build and start businesses, right? You should, as much as possible, encourage the private sector to come in and for government to stay away from directly being invested in businesses. So coming back to Malaysia Airlines, it's been very, very painful. It's been very directly impacted, right? But the global COVID pandemic really has shown essentially that the entire aviation industry is very, very dependent on public support at this point in time. We are not the only government that is supporting our national airline. Every government from Singapore to Europe to the US and everywhere else basically has had to step in. Because fundamentally, and I've been very open about this, right, without any kind of support from a substantial shareholder, airlines during this pandemic are essentially bankrupt, every single airline. That is really, I think, the harsh reality about why airlines have had to do downsizing, they've had to do essentially a lot of cost cutting. It's very painful.
Yeah.
But it is a necessity.
I agree with you there, Cheryl. There's no doubt about it. I mean, this is a real structural issue. But the issue I have with Malaysian Airlines is that even before COVID-19, it was already facing multiple crises. And, you know, money's been thrown at it. And my own back-of-envelope calculations is about 30 billion, plus minus a few billion here and there. But yet we seem to be no closer to a solution. So this time round, one more round of funding, 3.6 billion, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is the solution in sight?
So you're perfectly right. I think even before COVID, if you actually look at 2019, a good example, right? What has been the underlying problems with the aviation industry in Malaysia, right? So Malaysia Airlines has gone through a couple of restructurings, right? In fact, the Malaysia Airlines company that it is today is actually not the same as what it was before because we did one round where we transferred the business to a new corporate entity. But when we did that, and this was quite a few years ago, I think one of the things that we weren't able to address at the point in time, which we are addressing today, is essentially we carried over a lot of the old liabilities and assets on the balance sheet. And in 2019, we actually look at the aviation industry. The deep-rooted problem of the aviation industry in Malaysia is not just about Malaysia Airlines. If you actually look at the results of all the airline companies based in Malaysia in 2019, the fundamental problem with Malaysia has always been basically that in the last 10 years or so, we've allowed too much supply to come in
so
on a deregulated basis.
Five airlines for a country of 32 million is just way too many.
It's not just the fact it's five airlines. It's five airlines with an increasing number of planes and seats, right?
Mm.
And because of that, actually, every airline basically in 2019, even before COVID, was either losing money or essentially was close to losing money on its Malaysian operations. The reality essentially was just oversupply, killing essentially the average fare rate. Actually, even if COVID hadn't come, somebody would have gone to the wall, somebody would have gone bust this year.
But do you have free hands to do what you want? Because when I look back at the history of Malaysian Airlines, there have been many rounds of attempted restructuring and even mergers, talk of merging with AirAsia, for example, and that never went through. So do you have free hand today to do what needs to be done to get Malaysian Airlines up and running again?
Yeah, so I think one of, I won't call it a blessing, but certainly one of the side effects of COVID basically is that I think it's drawn all of this into a very stark relief, right? People now understand the fundamental problems of our aviation industry. Right? So it's not just us, right? Malindo, AirAsia, everybody's in the same trouble. Everybody needs to raise money to stay in business, or you have to withdraw from the market, which is what has happened, I think, if you look at Malindo, for instance, right? They've essentially withdrawn from this market. They just can't sustain it, right?
Mm-hmm.
AirAsia has got to go out to raise new capital, and they're in the midst of doing their own restructuring scheme. We are just the guys who managed to get it closed first because we went to the UK, very fast UK process in the High Court, got that scheme done. And that scheme basically will reset the balance sheet. It's actually going to remove more than 10 billion of liabilities on the balance sheet. Essentially does a debt to equity conversion for some of it. And it gets forgiveness from creditors for
it. Yeah, it's a very clever financial engineering, I would say. But Cheryl, the reality is this 3.6 billion that is the most recent bailout, is that going to be the final one? I mean, is it just
no?
I mean, any more money?
There's no guarantees in life, right? But what the restructuring scheme does is to give the best possible opportunity for Malaysia Airlines to reset itself for in terms of carrying liabilities, carrying planes that it doesn't need and could never make work, right? And certainly being able to then rethink about the business for the long term. So under the scheme as well, it provides permanent cuts to cost going forward as well of more than R1 billion a year. And that will help as well. Whether it's going to be enough is dependent on whether at the end of the day, post-COVID, there's a return to what happened pre-COVID, and which is basically something that all the airlines fear, which is unconstrained supply being allowed back in, destroying value for the future. And if that happens, basically every airline will be back in the same position.
So maybe the question is, do we really need a national airline? Is connectivity really so important?
Connectivity is hugely important. I think what you're seeing today basically is the fact that we do need connectivity, right? Otherwise, who's going to bring the vaccines that we need? Who's going to bring
But maybe it could be driven by commercial interests.
Oh, yeah, perfectly. I think in the long term, it still doesn't take away from the fundamental belief that once COVID's over, once basically there's a stabilization in the aviation industry, we should really then re-explore again. Basically, that whole question about whether government should be the sole owner of Malaysia Airlines, or whether we can actually bring in other partnerships. And I suspect really that post-COVID, you're going to see a realignment of global airlines because there's a sudden realization now basically that all the airlines are extremely vulnerable, right, when they're on their own to this kind of shocks. And I fully suspect basically that post-COVID, you are going to see global mergers, global partnerships and strategic partnerships in order to strengthen and share costs as much as possible.
Have those talks already started on Malaysian Airlines with some potential partners?
I think every airline in the world today is just more concerned about their own survival. So it's very unlikely that anyone's going to be doing a deal at this point in time until COVID's over. You've survived. Once you survive, then you can start thinking about
this. Okay, but Cheryl, that means surviving till probably, what, 2023? You know, Kazana, does it have the stomach for it?
Yeah, so the $3.5 billion that we are putting in is designed to take this airline all the way through for the next 5 years based on our assumptions around COVID. And we are assuming, you know, fairly dismal prospects for aviation and tourism until 2023, 2024.
Which leads to this question, you know, at what point does Kazana say enough is enough? The reason I'm asking this is because everything is viewed, I mean, in strategic investment, is viewed with the lens of long term. But does long term become a convenient excuse to hang on to an asset that, you know, perhaps will never turn around and also doesn't generate that minimum internal rate of return threshold that you have currently? So was Solterra one example?
Yes, very clearly yes, right? Now, which is why we've been actively trying to pursue a disposal strategy around Solterra, right? So we have to do the same thing. And I think, you know, you have to be honest enough, right, about the state of some of those assets. And discuss really with our parents that, you know, really is this strategy for long term? Does it make more sense to be in private sector hands? And maybe they can take it further.
What else is on your list that is ripe for divestment that you think, you know, doesn't fit into the Kazana portfolio, doesn't generate the returns you want?
So we should always ask this question about all the assets. It's not about trying to pick and choose which assets, right? As a portfolio investor, you must always have the discipline to always examine your portfolio. And think about, essentially, do we keep holding this asset? Is there a better opportunity for us to realize it and recycle the capital? And this is true of both the commercial fund and the strategic fund. Right? You have to do that.
In a special extended breakfast grill this morning, we are speaking to Dato' Cheryl Ridzwan, Managing Director of Kazana National. After the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin, what will be driving the performance of its commercial fund? BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, welcome back to a special extended breakfast grill where we're speaking to Dato' Cheryl Ridzwan, Managing Director of Kazana National. Before the news bulletin, we were talking about what will be the next strategic investments and when does the sovereign fund decide to throw in the towel. I want to spend some time on the performance of the commercial fund. So for 2020, this fund generated a two-year rolling time-weighted rate of return of 1.5%. Now the benchmark, I know internal benchmark that you have, is the long-term return of the consumer price index plus 3%, which might simple maths means about 4.3% per annum. So you're currently underperforming. Now, I want to understand why. Was it just due to the performance of the local assets?
Yeah, so primarily it is because of local assets, right? So if you look at the performance of markets, Bursa Malaysia, even though last year it ended up in the black, slightly in the back, right?
But it was very concentrated.
Very concentrated, and you know this as well.
It was
very
concentrated
really in just a few stocks, right? Healthcare, gloves, you know, a bit of electronics, exporters and stuff like that. But quite clearly, the Malaysian market has been underperforming global markets for a very long time. Right, and it's an issue that we have with our position in the world, and you know it's a more fundamental issue than just our investments in there. So and that's why, you know, for Kazana, as it is for other funds, you know, we do have to think about diversification away from those concentrated local risks, and you know, exposing ourselves to the kind of growth industries that you can't find on Bursa. right? Very, very important. So that's what we've been doing. And if you actually look at the breakdown that we've provided under our annual review, right, it's quite clear essentially that global markets have, you know, significantly performed well for us.
Yeah, 26% returns, right, for last year.
That's right. And that justifies why we've been putting more and more emphasis onto that, right? So last year during the COVID crisis, when markets went off, we actually put more money in. We saw it as an opportunity to buy into assets that we would otherwise have had to pay higher prices for. So that restructuring will take time. And that's why basically in terms of the benchmark, you know, ultimately we are targeting a five-year rolling return. The reason why it's a two-year rolling return today is because this strategy is only just into place for 2 years. But eventually it should be a five-year rolling return.
But is it going to be a challenge? Because when you think about it, right, markets have really recovered. Every asset class is on the tear. In this era of ultra low rates, there are many funds also chasing the same investments that you are. So how can you generate this kind of return? Are you actually perhaps even more cautious now, or what kind of a strategy are you adopting?
So it's quite clear, I think, you know, you look on a global basis, right? There's a lot of liquidity. There's a lot of euphoria around asset prices, which as a long-term investor, you have to be mindful of, right? That's why you have to try and enter the markets when there are dips. Right. It's not that if you look at the market, it's never a straight line. Even last year, very clearly, right, from the start of the year, there was a 20% dip in it by, you know, the end of the first quarter, and then it started to tear away after that. And even today, when you look at it, there's been another dip. So as an investor, you have to be able to time your entries and exits with a view towards building a long-term portfolio. And I think that's what all institutional investors try to do. A lot of the euphoria that you're seeing today is retail money that's driving sometimes valuations to peaks, which don't seem to make any sense, right, to any kind of long-term institutional investor. But it's necessary sometimes. You sometimes need people to provide liquidity, right, in order for you to trade the market.
So is there any particular concentration that you're looking at, maybe from a geographical perspective or from even a sectoral perspective for this commercial fund?
So the commercial fund is focused really on, especially focused on developed markets, as well as emerging markets in North Asia, right, and India as well. So these are traditionally areas where we built up a lot of expertise in terms of being able to invest globally, both in public markets and in private assets as well. The important thing is to maintain discipline. And we've had deals, especially in the last month or so, we've had a look at, which originally we thought we wanted to do, but then when pricing moved up, we just said, okay, we've got to be disciplined about this, right? And we will not go ahead with those transactions because we feel basically that now they're overpriced because other guys are chasing those assets. Is that the right thing to do in the long term? I think only time will tell. But I think, you know, historically, if you are a disciplined long-term investor, over the long term, basically, you will generate better returns than people who just trade on momentum or who trade essentially trying to just, you know, use up their dry powder.
And what are you then going to do with your key domestic holdings in the commercial funds? Because if I look at the performance of some of them, right? So I'm going to cite like UEM Agenta, that hasn't done very well. That's done down 43% from, you know, end of 2019, for example. Or even CIMB down 10%, Axiata down 10% or so. And this is against the backdrop of the KLCI, which is admittedly a very slight outperformance of 2.75%, or even the KL Emas up 5%. So what are you going to do about this? Is share price performance a KPI for these companies?
We tend to look at it as total returns. So a combination of dividends and combination of share price, right? But fundamentally, right, share markets are a reflection of demand and supply for any particular company. So in this case, essentially, right, in order for you to generate more demand for ownership of a particular company, you have to improve your operational performance.
Yeah. So do you drive that? Are you a very active shareholder?
So we try to be, you know, through our board representation, right? We try to drive the right set of KPIs. We are at the same time trying to make sure we have the right management in place. And in cases where it's worked out well, right? So TM, for example, in the last 1 year has seen a significant share price increase
as 60%,
new management came in and focused on cost measures, focused on driving revenue, right? Doing the right things. Right. So we're encouraging all our companies to think about that. And it's not just about organic. It's also about sometimes whether or not there are opportunities to think about inorganic paths towards better performance. And we do encourage them to think about that as well.
Is that why there was talk, which failed, unfortunately, of mergers with Axiata, Telenor, UEM, Sunrise with EcoWorld?
Correct. So we do encourage the management to think about, you know, is there a better path, right? Does it make sense to actually combine forces with someone else in a bid to both manage your costs downwards and also to find better synergistic opportunities on revenue as well. Right? So those are clear examples where we encourage the managements to explore with other companies.
With your blessings.
From our point of view, I think we are perfectly happy for management to think about these things, right? Because you want managers to think about delivering value to all shareholders, not just about us, right? In a lot of these companies, we are one shareholder among others. We may be the largest shareholder, but there are also other shareholders who should also benefit from this.
Can we expect more such talks in the future with any of your other companies?
We should encourage not just our companies, we should encourage more Malaysian companies to think about adding shareholder value, right? And, you know, as a market which is, like I said, under-owned by international investors, you have to think about how you can actually encourage international investors to think about Malaysia as a place where managements care about shareholder value, right? Very, very important, right? We've seen an erosion of that in the past.
Yeah, related to shareholder value or creation of it is also the market's faith in management, right? In the key, the CEO, for example, how he's going to drive the company and the corporate culture within. But recently in Malaysia, we have seen quite a fair bit of political appointments to boards, you know, and maybe in some of the companies that you're a major shareholder. So, I mean, what role does Khazanah play in pushing for maybe meritocracy on these boards and even women participation?
So we've always been proponents of trying to get more diversity, right?
And not just political appointments.
And not just for diversity for diversity's sake, right? And we've never really been very fond of political appointments. But we have to accept, I think, some of these companies, government continues to own a golden share. And I think you've heard me speak about golden shares before. I'm not going to repeat myself there. And secondly, I think in some of these companies, it's the exercise of the golden share, which is the government's right as shareholder. It is not something which other market participants are unaware of. I think, you know, it's very open basically, these companies do have a golden share and therefore government does have this right. And therefore, as a participant and as an investor in these companies, right, you have to take that into account.
Mm. And finally, Dato, I mean, I can see the clarity of direction and rationale behind the change in mandate in 2018. But will you see it through? Because there has been market noise that your three-year contract, which ends in August, might not be renewed. So have negotiations started? And if they offer you, would you like to continue as Managing Director of Khazanah?
So I think that's something which probably is a bit premature to talk about, honestly. It's a few months away, and certainly there will be conversations that we had as these things normally happen. What I'd like to emphasize actually basically is that we're talking about a core institution of the country, right? Just like the EPF or the PNB, you know.
And what's we saw very rapid departures, very sudden resignations.
Yeah, but it's what's important essentially is that you must create institutions which are long-lasting and which have the right processes, the right strategies in place, right? So I think, example, from my own experience, right, when I was at EPF, right, my main focus when I was there was really to create the right environment so that people can perform well, create essentially the right strategies and focus on the strategic asset allocation that has served EPF very, very well, even after I left. And that's really much more important. You need to create institutions which outlast governments and outlast the individuals who run them, right? And that's, I think, much more important for Malaysia as a whole.
So do you think you have made some headway in that direction, Cheryl? Because I think sometimes Malaysians have this maybe unfair view that, you know, Khazanah, there's a bit of a trust deficit. What is Khazanah doing? Is it just a vehicle for bailouts?
And I think, you know, Malaysians have a trust deficit with a lot of things, right? I mean, we can't run away from that. But with Khazanah, I think, you know, just, again, like, you know, my philosophy in all the organizations I've led basically is to increase transparency as much as possible, right? So with Khazanah, it's the same thing. We now have basically reports which are made public on our website. You know, people are free to download and to look at all these things. You know, we've increased the level of transparency around what we do and our financial results.
Perhaps not as transparent as, let's say, Norges or even Temasek when I compare their websites.
Actually, Temasek might not be a good example. Temasek doesn't really, you know, disclose everything either, right?
No, not everything.
Yeah.
So Norges is probably the most transparent.
Norges probably better, but Norges, I think you have to also understand, like, you know, these are Norwegians, right? Everything's transparent over there, and so
we can aspire.
They're very comfortable with it,
and right? We can aspire.
We should aspire, I think, to being a lot more transparent. But certainly, I think, you know, you also need to be a mature enough society to be able to handle that transparency when it comes, right? And, you know, I think that's something which is probably a long debate by itself as to what would Malaysians do with that amount of transparency in their lives.
Now, to be honest, Cheryl, you have served in different capacities within GLCs and GLICs from the days of Dana Hatta, which was in 1998. You've survived five prime ministers, three governments. You know, what makes you that survivor? Because not so many people have managed that.
Well, I don't see it as surviving. I see it essentially as, you know, I've been very, very blessed in the sense that I've been able to give back to Malaysia in terms of, you know, the work that I've done across multiple organizations. And certainly very, very proud of, I think, especially what I've done with EPF and Khazanah, which have a direct bearing on, you know, the people of Malaysia and, you know, the financial future of Malaysia, right? So in that sense, I think I've had a fairly good, you know, run in my career. And, you know, it's something which I think, you know, I'm very, very proud of. And certainly I'm quite pleased with how it's all going.
So if they offer you a renewal, will you be staying on? You didn't answer that question.
Keep coming back to that question.
Yes.
I think again, like I said, you know, very, very premature to start thinking about these things.
On that note, thank you for your time. On a special extended Breakfast Grill this morning was Dato' Sharul Ridzwan, Managing Director of Khazanah National. I'm Wong Xiao Ning, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.